This is Michael Cowan, and welcome to Trial Lawyer Nation.
You are the leader in the courtroom, and you want the jury to be looking to you for the answers.
When you figure out your theory, never deviate.
You want the facts to be consistent, complete, and credible.
The defense has no problem running out the clock. Delay is the friend of the defense.
It's tough to grow a firm by trying to hold on and micromanage.
You've got to front load a simple structure for jurors to be able to hold on to.
What types of creative things can we do as lawyers, even though we don't have a trial setting?
Whatever you've got to do to make it real, you've got to do to make it real. But the person who needs convincing is you.
Welcome to the award-winning podcast, Trial Lawyer Nation. Your source to win bigger verdicts, get more cases, and manage your law firm. And now, here's your host, noteworthy author, sought-after speaker, and renowned trial lawyer, Michael Cowan.
We're going to start a new feature on this podcast. It's Ask Michael and Mallory Anything. If you have anything you'd like to ask either Mallory or me, we're going to start doing an episode every couple months where we're going to answer your questions. So just send them in to me at michael@cowanlaw.com, and Mallory and I will answer them. Anything from, you know, legal strategy, marketing management, anything else in life you want to talk about, we'll be glad to talk about it with you. Again, ask Michael and Mallory anything. Just send us an email. We'll be glad to answer your questions. Today on Trial Lawyer Nation, I am joined by my partner, Natalie Arledge. Natalie, how are you doing today?
I'm good, Michael. How are you?
I'm doing fantastic. Natalie, you got a great verdict, $1.7 million, on a case that had a number of challenges, and I thought it would be really helpful to the audience for you to come and talk about the case, and more importantly, like, how did you overcome all of these challenges to get this fantastic verdict on a case that, frankly, I wasn't sure that there was a way to get there between you and me.
Yes, so, I'm happy to do that. I'm glad to be here.
So let's, before we get into the challenges, tell me a little bit about the basics of the case.
Well, this was a trucking case. This was a case that involved an 18-wheeler. Our client is in one lane, and the 18-wheeler is in another lane. The 18-wheeler wants to change lanes, and so starts to enter our client's lane. Our client sees him coming and tries to avoid a crash, and so she's steering out of the way, and she ends up losing control in the median and crashing in the median. And that kind of leads to that first big challenge, was there wasn't actually any contact between the 18-wheeler and our client's vehicle.
And what happened to her?
Well, at the time, so she's an 18-year-old college student coming home for Thanksgiving break. And she ended up, I mean, just to put it in a nutshell, she ended up with years and years of medical care. She had a lot of procedures. She had a lot of injections. She ended up having two different surgeries, back surgeries. At the end of the day, she ended up with a spinal cord stimulator that she's going to live with for the rest of her life. She was, you know, only 25 years old by the time we tried this case.
And I know she had some real injuries, and I know that she got them from this crash, but we had some challenges in this case. And so let's start with the, you mentioned one. One challenge was that the two vehicles did not actually make contact with each other. Any other challenges on liability?
Well, you know, okay, now that I'm thinking about it, one of the other challenges that we had was the police officer was against us. He put in his report that it was our client's fault that she had lost control. And so we had to kind of overcome that as well.
Didn't the, not just the police officer was against us, but the truck driver had a story that was trying to exonerate himself, and then the defense also hired their own crash reconstructionist.
Yes. So the defense was able to put together a story between what the driver said and their reconstructionist to say that our client was actually driving behind him, tried to come around the 18-wheeler as he's making his lane change, and she got in his way, which is why the crash happened.
Which wasn't true, but they still said it.
Yes. And it was hard to overcome. I mean, it was hard to say that didn't happen.
So that's the liability challenge. Now, you had some damages challenges. So she was really hurt. She got a lot of medical treatment. But when did that treatment start?
That treatment didn't start till a couple weeks after this crash. Actually, more than that, maybe 5 weeks after this crash.
Yeah, because she got in the crash on the way home for Thanksgiving. And then on Christmas break, she went to the doctor once, and then in February, she got an MRI, and then she really started treating. But even that, the first year and 10 months, it was just like conservative care, some therapy, and it wasn't until long after that she actually started getting the more invasive treatment, like a year and 10 months after the crash.
Yes. Yeah. She really didn't start getting any significant treatment until much later. And even after she started getting significant treatment, we had another gap there for about a year. And I think that's one of the challenges, though, coming with younger clients. I mean, you know, one, they don't believe that they're really that hurt, so they don't want to go. Two, they're busy with, you know, their lives and school, and they don't want to take the time out to go to the doctor. But, you know, those are all things that we had to explain.
So I want to start with how you overcame these challenges, and then I'll go into the trial itself. So let's start with the liability. You've got, you know, we've got our reconstructionists. They have the reconstructionists. They have the cop on their side. You know, we have our story. They have their story. How did you present, and how did you solve that puzzle to show liability on the part of the tractor trailer?
What I decided to do was just to keep it as simple as possible. We talk all the time about how confusion is the friend of the defense, and I feel like that's what was happening with stories about her coming from behind and who was really in the lane and where, who was where. You know, those were all the defense's stories. And I decided just to try to boil it down to just very simple, that this is a lane change. It doesn't matter where she came from or what was happening, but the facts are that we know she was here and he was here. And my opening was very short on liability because I said all it is he was going into her lane. He went into her lane. And there was no doubt about that. I mean, everybody agreed he went into her lane. And so that's what I tried to focus on mostly, was just keeping it as simple as possible for the jury and not confusing them with all these other stories.
So what are the rules that the truck driver is supposed to follow when making a lane change?
Well, it's actually a pretty lengthy process to change lanes. When the drivers are wanting to change lanes, they have to check their mirrors first. So they have the plane mirrors, they have the convex mirrors, and then they have the fender mirrors that allow them to see all down the side. They have to check those mirrors, I think it's every 2 to 3 seconds. And also at certain points when they're ready to enter the lane, as they're entering the lane, before they complete the change. And so they're supposed to be checking, double checking, and triple checking those mirrors before they change lanes.
Any argument that, you know, our client was in the blind spot?
Yes, yes. They said that was a kind of another issue with liability, was that she was in the blind spot. The driver wrote on his incident report that she was in his blind spot. And so we brought in our experts to talk about, I loved it at trial. He said that, you know, blind spots are a myth. And I just kept saying that throughout the rest of the trial. Blind spots are a myth. Trying to get that to stick into the jury's mind.
Did you do anything to show the jury that they are a myth?
We did a few things. So I did try to make a lot of visuals for this case. I think for me anyways, it was easier for me to keep it simple with visuals. And so I was hoping that it would be the same for the jury. So we drew on our King flip chart how blind spots work, how changing lanes works. And then our trucking expert, he was awesome. He set up a picture of an 18-wheeler, the tractor and the trailer, and he put out cones to show where the mirrors can see next to the truck. And so he had the orange cones, and he said, this is what you can see in your convex mirror. And this is yellow cones, you could see this in your fender mirror. And we were able to break it down for the jury to show them that, look at all these areas. As long as the driver's doing what he's supposed to be doing when he changes lanes, he could see through all of these areas. And I think the jury really caught on to that, because it was just a visual way to see, like, what is this driver supposed to see? He's supposed to see everything.
Do you use any other material showing, you know, that there's not really blind spots?
Gosh, we used materials from the Commercial Motor Vehicle Driver's Handbook. We used, there's some good graphs in there, some good illustrations.
Yeah, when I was going through the file, I actually went through your file because I was looking for materials to use for a presentation. And
oh, good.
And you had some good ones in there. And what I saw, yeah, with the picture with the cones and then the actually, I was looking for the picture with the cones because I'm going to give a speech in Austin on using demonstratives and doing demonstrations and reenactments. And that's one of the demonstrations I want to use. But while I was looking for the cone one, I clicked on some other ones that looked like they were from the Commercial Driver's License Manual or from a truck, you know, a truck driving school textbook or something like that.
Yes. Yes. I tried to find a couple of different anchors to help us talk about the blind spots.
And I think the fact that you were smart enough to not just get the pictures that our expert took, but to also have the other industry publications. And so the weakness of the publications is it's just a drawing. It is not real. But then when our expert does something, there's that argument, well, that's just the expert saying, and of course he's rigging it to come out the way you want it to. So I think when you combine with, like, this is what our expert showed, and it's also consistent with what's in the published literature, then it's just more believable.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I agree. And it gave our expert a lot of credibility, and it gave us credibility that we're not here just making these things up because this is what the result that we want, but this is really what the rules say.
And was there a lot of property damage on this case?
No, not at all. When she crashed, she had crashed into the median, but I mean, I think the most, she hit a stop sign or a speed limit sign. And so there was a little dent in the bumper from the speed limit sign. But other than that, she didn't really hit anything. It was more the terrain that she was going in. It was, you know, it was a ditch. So that's kind of where we think more of her, the biomechanics came into play, but really no property damage. None from the truck, even.
Yeah. How did you establish then how she could get hurt without the vehicle getting hurt?
We hired our collision analyst, and he is the one that came in and was able to explain about, he explained how she lost control, because we had to explain how that wasn't her fault either to have lost control. And he explained about how going into the ditch and the way that her body moved, how that caused her to have some herniated discs or aggravation of some herniated discs, and why that ended up with her needing more treatment.
So then how did you, I mean, I remember you and I talked about the case, and the major truth in the case is she did get hurt, and people can get hurt even if they don't go to the doctor. That doesn't mean they're not hurt. But how did you overcome the fact that she had such huge initial delays in getting medical treatment?
Well, so, you know, I have to give you a lot of credit, Michael, because, you know, you were wonderful throughout this whole case, giving great advice and helping me strategize on this case. And one of your strategies was to put her up for testimony first, which is kind of a no-no almost, right? They say don't ever start with the plaintiff. But maybe I'll let you explain that a little bit more as to why we would want to put her first.
Yeah, well, I just want to be clear that while you and I collaborated as far as strategy, I was not there for the trial. This was your baby, and all the glory goes to you because you're the one that tried the case. So I don't want people to go out there thinking I'm taking credit for your work.
No, never.
And while I'm being honest there, I have to say the reason I suggested it, I had never done that before. And I'd always thought, like, either put the plaintiff on last or bury the plaintiff in between other people so that way they impeach them badly, you have other people to make up for it. But I heard a podcast with Keith Mitnick, and so this is purely Keith Mitnick's idea, not mine. And he said, if the whole case is going to be about the plaintiff's credibility, and they're doing all these cross-examinations on whether the plaintiff's going to be credible or not, like, if the plaintiff hasn't testified yet, they're going to be thinking in the back of their head, well, maybe she's full of it, maybe she's not lying. And then by the time the plaintiff gets there, there are all those doubts. So he just says, call the plaintiff first. Plaintiff's either going to do a good job or they're not. And the plaintiff does a good job and was believable, then all those insinuations they bring up later with other witnesses really ring hollow. Because, mm-hmm. Like, well, I heard this lady. I believed her. And we don't. And they're, you know, they're repeating the same thing over and over again. So I think that, well, obviously the results show that Keith Mitnick's advice was right. But I also think it's plugging our show here and other people's shows. It shows the value of listening to podcasts. Because I'm driving to, you know, I've got a long commute every morning because I take my son to school in another county. So I drive, you know, he doesn't want to listen to podcasts. So I drive him to school in the morning, and then I've got 30 to 40 minutes from his school to our office. And so I use that for when it's not football season, use that for learning time. When it's football season, I listen to college football podcasts. But this wasn't football season, so I listened to Keith Mitnick and got the idea and shared it with you.
Well, I'm glad you did, because I think that made such a big difference for us. And the client herself really was an asset to her own case. She's a young girl. I mean, she was very nice, very likable. And I think you were right in putting her up first. I knew the jury was going to like her. And I think that definitely helped.
So how did you address the delay with her?
I didn't harp on it too much. We brought it up a little bit during her direct, and we kind of used those explanations that she's young. She was in college at the time. She had had some other, like, family issues. She was homeless for a little bit. She didn't have that kind of adult support. She didn't have any parents helping her, guiding her. So we kind of talked about how, you know, she really just didn't have the guidance and support she needed to get the treatment she needed. She knew, I mean, and being so young, I don't think she really understood what kind of treatment she needed. Yeah, I mean, we kind of talked through her story a little bit, but I didn't want to make too big of a deal of it, and I don't think the defense made a big enough deal of it, and mm-hmm. so we really didn't spend a whole lot more time on it after that. We got our explanation out there, and you know what? And then we just decided we're going to just trust the jury. I mean, yeah. We have to leave it to them. That is the true story, and it's up to them to decide.
Other than medical doctors, did you have anyone else to show that she was hurt?
We did. We brought in a couple of witnesses that were close to her. We brought in her sister, and she came and testified. We also brought in her grandmother and her second grade teacher, which I just thought that was amazing. They had known each other for so long, but he was still part of her life. And he was a great witness because he talked to her on the phone maybe a couple times a year. And he was able to really give the jury a good idea of, well, you know, I talked to her last year and this wasn't happening to her. And then I talked to her the next year and she was having all these problems.
Yeah.
So, yes. So those people came in and helped us as well.
That's great. So expert wise, so you had your crash reconstruction kind of bio expert. You had a trucking expert. Any other experts that you called?
We called our treating surgeon and he came and testified by Zoom. We did have some experts that we decided not to call.
Okay.
Which made me a little nervous at first.
Tell me about that.
So we had a life care planner that we were going to call that we decided not to.
So what was the logic of not calling the life care planner?
Well, I think part of the reasoning that we decided not to call the life care planner, was because she had had those gaps in treatment, we thought we would lose a little credibility saying she's going to need, you know, this kind of treatment this many times per year for how many years. But she had already not had a lot of that treatment, or she had been skipping a lot of treatment. So we felt we were going to lose credibility. And we decided that with our treating surgeon and with the spinal cord stimulator and that damage model, that we could still get a pretty good future economic damage model with that. And so just basically to save credibility, we didn't want to put anything in front of the jury that was going to, they were going to have to wrestle over more. There was already plenty to wrestle over in the case.
Yeah. And I think part of it, you know, we got brought into the case when it was already had been in litigation for quite a while. And, you know, our wonderful co-counsel brought us in, and he had hired a life care planner, not a physician life care planner. And I know lots of lawyers, I'm not criticizing that. It's just something I prefer to have a doctor testify. But I do think it was an old life care plan. There had been, you know, changes in the treatment, and rather than get it updated, and all the life care planners, since the life care wasn't a doctor, would say, well, I updated it. Like, a lot of the treatment I originally recommended was not done, and now this other treatment was done, but it's all based on the future, on what this other doctor tells me. We'll just get the other doctor to say it. And I think it's more credible to have, not that I don't use life care planners a lot, but I mean, if it's coming from your treating physician, it's even better.
Yes. I think using our treating surgeon was a big win for us.
So let's go through then and let's talk about the trial. So let's start with the pretrial motions and stuff. Tell me about that.
Oh my goodness. Well, the one thing that sticks out of my mind is their 89-point motion in limine. Yeah, so the pretrial motions, we actually had those the same day that we started trial, before we picked a jury. And it was tough. I mean, it was something that I definitely needed some help on. And my wonderful law partners, Sonia Rodriguez and Mallory Peacock, came in and helped me on that first day. You know, it definitely is not a job for one person to do the pretrial motions.
Yeah, absolutely. It's so hard to be arguing the motions and thinking about jury selection and picking the jury and trying to take your own notes. I mean, I used to do it when I did smaller cases, but I really do highly encourage our listeners. I mean, whether you get someone at your own firm, whether you get a friend, whether you get a co-counsel, but get someone to go in there with you on day one when you're arguing the motions and picking the jury, because it's just too much for one person to do on their own.
Mm-hmm. And just trying to keep track of all the rulings on the 89 points in motion in limine, yeah. Right? I mean, it's hard to keep track of that while you're thinking of the next one that you need to argue.
And then the jury selection. Tell me about what jury selection was like. So you're in Bexar County, Texas, San Antonio, where they try to do jury selection a little different sometimes, where they do this general where you have to ask questions to the group, but you can't follow up, and then specific where it's one person at a time, but then it's not always enforced. Like, I always just ignore that and do it my way. But Tell me about how that all worked.
I think that's pretty much what I did. I think the judge had initially thought we were going to do general and specific, and I had never done that before. And I was going to get up and do what I was going to do, and the judge was going to tell me if I couldn't be doing that, and she never did. So, yeah. You know, I am grateful for our judge. She did let us just try the case. She didn't interfere a whole lot. There was 65 people there in our jury panel. And we had people, again, come from our office. Sonia and Mallory were there, but we had Jewish Risa Mott. But everybody was taking notes during jury selection. And so that was awesome because at the end, I could just focus on talking. At the end, everybody had picked out something different for each juror. And so I liked having different perspectives, different things stuck out to different people, and we could kind of weed through what we wanted at that point. But we were thrown off a little bit because once we had done the strikes, somebody reminded the judge that there were other people on the panel that should have been excused before they even got on the panel, and there was a mix-up. So after we had all the strikes done, then we had to go back and take out more people that had to be excused. So that kind of threw us all off again. So it was interesting.
Did you have to stick with those strikes, or did you get a second bite at the apple? Or
no, we had to stick with the strikes. We had done everything.
Wow.
And then, right, so we finally got our jury impaneled, and it was something totally different than what I think we had all expected. And another juror stood up, and she says, I don't speak English very well. So luckily, we had picked some alternates, so we were able to get an alternate in right away. But yes, it was just... it was a grab bag for jury selection.
Now, you actually had a nurse practitioner on your jury?
We did, yes. A board-certified nurse practitioner, yes.
So, you know, the traditional logic, which I don't always agree with, is like, don't let anyone from the medical field on your jury because they're going to be experts and they're going to go. Do you think it helped you or hurt you to have the nurse practitioner on your jury?
I think she helped. So one thing, not only was she a nurse practitioner, she was also the only woman on our jury.
Oh, really?
Yes. So we had a jury of 11 men and one woman. And I thought she was going to be good for us because she said some really good things during jury selection. She had talked about pre-existing conditions and that pain doesn't always come up from a crash immediately. And so I knew that she would help us with the gaps in treatment and all the treatment that our client did end up having. So I think she was helpful to us in that way.
Now there's a couple things I want to say to that. You know, I think it's so important, and you did such a good job, is one, don't base things on stereotypes. Like, listen to people, listen to what they say, and then you've got to trust your intuition. There is some science to trial, but there's a lot of this that's art, and you just learn, when you learn to trust your gut, it's right most of the time. Mm-hmm. And so I'm so proud of you for having the courage to let a medical professional on a jury when it felt right to you and she said the right things.
Thank you. Yes. It was the right move, it seems.
And so opening, you said you gave a short opening. Just can you just talk about what kind of structure you used?
Yes. So I used your structure for opening.
Thank you.
No, thank you. You and I, you know, we had the opportunity to sit down and you walked through that structure with me. Oh, gosh, I couldn't tell you what it is from memory right now, but we talked a little bit about liability and what are their defenses to the liability, and same thing with the damages and what are their defenses. And maybe you know it better than I do.
Well, yeah. I mean, I've taken the David Ball and Sard Elamot structure and made some minor modifications to it. And I think the biggest one with me is what Sari calls the hook. I mean, David Ball says start with the roll. Sari says start with the hook. I start by trying to enroll the jury and, like, this is what you're here for and this is how I'm going to help you do your job. And so it's just a little different at the beginning. But it's there's so many teachers have such similar structures because they work, which is, you know, you give some context for why the juror is there. I like teaching them how to do it right before you say what the defendant did wrong. Talking about liability from what the defendant did, bringing up a client last so, you know, you don't have any defense. You minimize the chance of defensive attribution. Don't talk about damages till you talk about liability, those kind of things. Undermine the liability things before you go into damages. But and then did you ask for money? Did you give a number in voir dire or in opening?
I did to both, yes.
Why is that?
To kind of prime the jury a little bit, to give them an idea of what I would be asking for at the end. I didn't tell them I was asking for this in jury selection. I just mentioned, I think it was $3 million. And then in opening, I asked for $3 million, but I don't want that number to be a surprise to anybody. you know, people don't realize like what medical bills are and, you know, what these damages can add up to very easily. And so you don't want to spring it on them at the very end when maybe they came up with a different number in their head that was much, much lower.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, I think it's always good to own your number as early as possible, and then the jurors have that number in their mind the whole time. How did you come up with $3 million?
Well, I looked at our damage model first, and then I just thought about what sounded reasonable to me, honestly. You know, I knew I couldn't go in there asking for $50 million. That's just not that some case, this just was not one of those cases, but I knew that I needed to ask for enough that my client was going to recover enough that all that she needed, but I didn't want to go too crazy and turn the whole jury off. And to me, $3 million just sounded like a reasonable number.
Yeah, well, you have to believe it. That's the biggest thing. And, you know, had she had a lot of property damage and been taken to the hospital in an ambulance and then had the outcome she had, you probably would have asked for more. But you do have to bring into account you've got, you know, you've already got some hurdles to overcome. So you want to ask for enough, but you know, if you had all those hurdles and asked for $50 million, you may have really turned off that jury.
It would have been an easy no for some people.
Exactly. So as far as the structure of the trial, you started with the plaintiff. What was, do you remember the general order of witnesses after that?
After the plaintiff, I think I presented our liability experts after that for the most part, because we did the plaintiff first. And then I think the next morning we started with our collision analyst and then we did our trucking expert. So I brought them in just to tell me, help explain kind of how the crash happened more. And then we did our other damages experts that same day. Actually, no, I take that back. We did our damages witnesses. Her grandmother and her sister and her teacher. I think we did those before our liability experts just to kind of help pump up her credibility a little bit and reinforce what she had just told the jury. No, sorry. Yes. Now that I'm remembering, we put them on first and then we did our experts after that.
And I think in that case, you know, my general rule is, you know, convince the jury on liability before you move to damages. That being said, if they believed your client, I mean, it's not like look in your mirrors and don't switch lanes and hit people. It's that controversial. And I do think the biggest issue in this case is, was she really hurt, given that she took her 5 weeks to see a doctor and then a couple months to see a doctor again? Were all these horrible injuries that she's suffering from now related to the crash that she didn't treat for a lot then? So I think it was the right thing in this case to start with the damages, even though normally I would say you start with liability. And I think that's just another key that, you know, we should never just be following a formula for every case. You have to look at what are my biggest issues in the case and what is the best way to overcome them.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I totally agree. Yes, if it taught me anything, it was to trust your intuition.
So who did the defense call?
So the defense ended up not calling their driver or their corporate representative. I didn't learn until right before trial that their driver was not going to be there. And so I kind of had to rearrange some witnesses and some things I was doing. But I decided I didn't need to call the corporate representative for my case either. So they ended up not calling anybody from the company.
Experts. Did they present any testimony from the driver in deposition or anything, or just...
They did. They did later, yes, because I ended up having to do some deposition testimony for the driver, but I think they were just kind of following what I was doing, not necessarily doing it for their own strategy.
Right. And as far as their experts, what kind of experts did they have?
They also had an accident reconstructionist, and he was a former police officer. And so one of the things that I took home after talking to the jury at the end of the case was there was a big difference between our reconstructionist and the defense's reconstructionist. Our reconstructionist is MIT graduate. He's a PhD. He's engineering teacher. And then the defense's expert was a former police officer. And so they both were great in their own ways, but in the jury's mind, you know, that was a big difference for them. They weren't sure that they could trust the police officer as much as they could trust the MIT graduate. So I thought that was interesting. Yes, the defense had their accident reconstructionist. They had a billing expert and an orthopedic surgeon, a joint replacement specialist.
Yeah. Well, let's go one by one. So what was your strategy in crossing their crashed reconstructionist?
Well, he was tough because I had a tough time with the liability. I couldn't explain away the stories they had come up with about how she got into the lane and how long they were there. And I'm not an engineer or a crash reconstructionist. So my strategy was not to get into his sandbox to play. I tried to pick the easiest things that I knew everybody on the jury would understand and that I understood. So I was able to get on, which I didn't know before, but during trial, he admitted that he had not reviewed some document. And then I went through some other documents and he admitted he hadn't reviewed several documents. And the jury at the end told me that that was a big thing for them. Like, this guy shows up here and he didn't even look at everything before he came and told us his opinion. So I didn't know much about yaw marks and skid marks and angles and coefficient of friction, right? But I did know that he didn't review everything.
Yeah. I think that's, and that's something that the jury doesn't know about yaw marks and coefficients of friction either, but they do know to do your job, you need to read all the evidence and not just cherry pick what helps you.
Yes. Yes. So that was my strategy with him for sure. And really the other experts as well.
So how about the medical billing people? Because that's a bigger and bigger issue in cases. You know, I've even seen people say when health insurance paid the bill, the health insurance paid too much and it should be more like what Medicare pays. But, you know, in this case, we had, you know, treatment on a lien or a letter of protection and a big bill. And you had the defense arguing that the bill should be a lot less. What did you do to handle that expert?
Oh, you know, I had come up with an outline of things that I wanted to ask her and try to make points about. But during her direct, I scrapped everything. And I think I asked her maybe three questions at the end. Because during her direct, sometimes, I don't know if this is nice to say, but you got to give them enough rope to hang themselves with.
Yes, that's exactly appropriate.
So that's what was happening during her direct. They took, it had to be over an hour that she was on direct. And in my mind, that's a long time. And for anything, especially when you're talking about CPT codes and UCR codes, and I mean, it is just so highly technical. I don't understand anything about it, really. You know, they had a bunch of slides with a bunch of writing on it, and they were trying to educate the jury on all of these things, but I don't think it was necessary. So I thought that they had lost the jury at some point for sure. And so I didn't want to lose the jury when I started. I wanted to just make my points and leave. And right. So by the time that she was done, I felt like they were already lost. And so I think I asked her a couple of questions, just, you agree that my client, she has no control over what her doctors bill her.
Yeah.
She agreed with that. I think maybe I asked her one or two other things and we just moved on. And in closing, I left it to the jury too, as far as like the medical bills. I said, you know, you've heard from our doctors that say that these bills are reasonable and you've heard from the defense and I'm going to leave it up to y'all. And I'm so grateful I did, because I think the jury didn't know what to do either. They ended up just cutting the bills in half, right? They just split the baby between us and I was happy with that result.
Yeah, the bills were maybe high enough where we weren't upset by having them cut in half. We'll put it nicely. But I will say that was a win for the case, because you had, and I think not the, and it's not anything with this specific doctor, it's just the American medical finance and billing system is dysfunctional. And I think to the extent we try to defend the indefensible, we lose credibility. But when we make the argument, well, we don't set how medical bills are done. It's not the way I would do it, but she still owes them. I mean, that's the problem. I mean, she didn't have any choice on how medical billing gets done. And she, you know, if you don't like the system, well, then don't crash into people and hurt them. Mm-hmm. You know, but once you hurt somebody, you can't complain that, like, you know, that it's just not fair that doctors charge too much or hospitals charge too much. That's what they charge. So I think that was totally the way to do it.
Yes.
And I also really, really commend you for listening, for reading the jury and listening to your gut. Like, so many people think, well, I did all the work. I've got the outline. I have to make sure I make every single point. And then, you know, they almost add credibility to this person by going and arguing all these little points that are already confusing. I mean, you read the room, you saw that what she was saying wasn't hitting, and you scrapped your outline, made your points, and went home. And that's what being a trial lawyer is all about, is feeling that energy between you, the jury, and everybody else, and doing what's necessary for the jury and having the courage to depart from your outline or what someone else told you to do.
Yes.
The defense medical doctor. So you said they had a joint replacement specialist, but there was no joint replacement in this case. Tell me, why did you call him a joint replacement specialist?
Well, that's because he—that's what he specializes in. And I have to give a lot of credit to Jason Pagel at our firm. He came and he helped me with some of the witnesses the last couple days of trial. So while I had the doctor up there and he was testifying, Jason's over there researching this doctor, and he found it all while we were sitting there listening to his direct. And again, I took my outline, I just crossed off the front part and put those questions up front. That this guy, he advertised on his website, he was a joint replacement specialist, is specializing in knees and hips. And so that was fun to call that out in the jury, to the jury, that he doesn't operate on spines. I didn't know the answers, but after finding out he was a joint replacement specialist, I could guess what his answers were. And so I think I asked him when the last time he operated on a spine was, and it was 20 something years ago. He'd never done the percutaneous disc discectomy or decompression that our client had done. He'd never done that procedure. And so that kind of became the focus a little bit before I got into the other nitty gritty depo things, was this guy is not qualified to be here to testify about this.
Yeah, that's, I think, again, that's so brilliant to just pick with simple things that the jurors, I mean, even though you had a nurse practitioner on there, you might be able to get some of the more technical stuff for the other 11 jurors weren't, and you know, but they do know that, hey, why are you hiring a knee and shoulder doctor to testify about the back? Well, maybe that's who will say what you want.
Yes. You know what else I love too was their doctor, I don't know if he didn't put it in his calendar or what, but he showed up to testify by Zoom from the lobby in his hotel.
Oh my gosh.
So there's people like walking around behind him. It was really weird at the ATM behind him. It was funny.
So how did you handle the rest of your docket? Because, you know, we had hearings set, you had other things while you're in trial.
Oh, well, I am so grateful to have so much support here at our firm. I have a great team that I work with, and you really can't think about anything else. And they were able to handle everything while I was gone. My paralegal, my legal assistant, they took care of everything. And then for the things that my team couldn't do, I mean, I relied on the other lawyers here as well to help me with certain things that needed a lawyer's touch, and everybody was so willing to help. And so, I mean, I had to find people to babysit for me.
I flew to New Mexico and covered 2 days of federal court hearings for you.
That's right. That's right. I forgot about those, but I know you didn't.
Yep. Yep. Well, we managed to pull that stuff off too.
Right.
It all worked out.
That's all we needed. That's all I needed the week before trial was, by the way, you've been scheduled for 2 federal court hearings in New Mexico the same week you're in trial.
Yep. In closing, how'd you bring it all home?
I'll be honest, by the time closing came around, I was so tired. And I knew the jury was tired too, though, because it was kind of a long trial. I thought we could get that trial done in 4 days, but we were there from Monday until the following Monday. So the jury had to go home over the weekend. I knew they were grumpy about having to come back on a Monday, and I didn't want to beat them over the head for 45 minutes with everything. So I just stuck to my strategy, which was just to keep it simple. And I just reiterated some of the points that I had made during the opening and how we proved those points, left it to them a lot on a lot of things like the medical bills, and said, you know, y'all heard the testimony here and it's unfair to my client and the medical billing system, but I'm going to leave it to y'all to decide. So I know they were tired and they just wanted to make a decision. I think they were probably ready to make a decision that Friday, but they had to come back. So,
well, I mean, I think trusting the jury, it's all we can do is trust them, right? And the more you trust them, the better it works. So let's talk about mindset. And so a trial, as much as we talk about, you know, we're going to be positive and stuff, and we try to be, a trial is a journey. And I know, because I got a text from you at 4 a.m. one day, that, you know, there were some low points. So can you tell me a little bit about the low points and then what you did to come back?
Yes. So, 4 a.m, you couldn't guess how I was feeling. I think that was the night that I was here at the office until midnight with the client, and basically was going home to take a shower and get ready to come the next day. And, you know, I think one of the biggest issues for me that I was struggling with was I didn't feel prepared. And so, I had a couple moments where I was like, oh my gosh, I mean, I don't know that I'm going to make it. I don't know that I'm going to make it to the end of this.
And I was feeling bad because I originally was going to try the case with you. And then we had our only lawyer in the New Mexico office leave, and we hadn't replaced her yet. And so I was having to work an extra full-time job. And then we had those federal court hearings in New Mexico. Mm-hmm. And you told me that you would do it without me, and I took you up on it. But then you suddenly had to do all the work that I was going to do. and so you did kind of. But I mean, kudos to you for not seeing a continuance, and, you know, and because the other side wanted one, and pushing forward and doing it anyway.
Yes.
So how did you come back from that? Like, you're feeling overwhelmed. You're feeling, you know.
I'm grateful that I felt like I could trust you and trust everybody else here at the firm to ask for help. I mean, there's just nothing else I could do except for ask for help. If I didn't ask for help, I would have been worse. And sometimes it wasn't even that I needed the help, but it was more like maybe I just need a little pep talk. Even just a little pep talk reassuring me that it's okay you don't know everything. It's okay you don't know every little detail. Yeah. I think at one point I had told you, I was like, oh, I can't remember how to do an offer of proof. What if I need to do an offer of proof? And I had a little moment of panic, and you said, well, you know, unless you're planning on appealing it, you don't really need to know how to do it. And I was like, okay, that's true. I mean, okay, I guess I'll just, if I need to do one, I'll try, but pressure.
That's what I said. Would we really appeal this one if we lost? No. And would we have any basis to appeal? Would it be reversible error? If not, you don't need to do offer of proof.
Yes.
So what did you do? I mean, did you have any mindset stuff that you did to help yourself?
I have to say I am heavily influenced by you, of course. But yes, I mean, you'd been telling us for months, and I kept telling myself, trust the jury, trust the jury. And it's true. I mean, I was a little nervous that it was 11 men and one woman, because I thought, well, you know, I'm a woman, my client's a woman. I don't know if we're going to be able to connect. Are we going to be able to speak everybody's language and get them to a place where they can see this, you know, our way? And, you know, but I quickly kind of threw that out of my head. It's like, I can't judge people because of their gender. I just have to put the truth out there, and I have to be honest and vulnerable and let them decide. So yes, trust the jury and that they're going to see the truth. That was a big one. And be grateful. That was the other thing I kept trying to remind myself. I was grateful for my team, grateful for my law partners. You know, there's a lot of things that go wrong that you could not be grateful for, but remembering what you do have is very important.
Well, I am so proud of you. It was such an incredible result. And let's be honest. I mean, I had the choice of trying that case or going and covering hearings, and I chose to cover the hearings. It was a very, very challenging case. And while I've tried lots of challenging cases, I'm ready to pass that torch on. You did such an incredible job. I don't think I would have done as well as you did. I think that it was an incredible result for the client, and I'm so proud of you, and I can't wait to see your next trial.
Oh, thank you. I can't wait for it either. It was a lot of fun.
Thank you all so much for joining us on Trial Lawyer Nation.
Thank you for joining us on Trial Lawyer Nation. I hope you enjoyed our show. If you'd like to receive updates, insider information, and more from Trial Lawyer Nation, sign up for our mailing list at triallawyernation.com. You can also visit our episodes page on the website for show notes and direct links to any resources in this or any past episode. To help more attorneys find our podcast, please like, share, and subscribe to our podcast on any of our social media outlets. If you'd like access to exclusive plaintiff lawyer only content and live monthly discussions with me, send a request to join the Trial Lawyer Nation Insider Circle Facebook group. Thanks again for tuning in. I look forward to having you with us next time on Trial Lawyer Nation.
Each year, the law firm of Cowan Rodriguez Peacock pays millions of dollars in co-counsel fees to attorneys nationwide on trucking and commercial vehicle cases. If you have an injury case involving death or catastrophic injuries and would like to partner with our firm, please contact us by calling 210-941-1301 to discuss the case in detail and see where we can add value in a partnership. This podcast has been hosted by Michael Cowan and is not intended to, nor does it create, the attorney-client privilege between our host, guest, and any listener for any reason. Content from the podcast is not to be interpreted as legal advice. All thoughts and opinions expressed herein are only those from which they came.